Al will be forever the myth.
You're the king of kings, Al.
There's always a pecking order. The little peckers never mess with the big peckers. So I'm a rooster, and he's a chicken.
This episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast is brought to you by our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine. All right, welcome everybody to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I'm your host, John Hansen, and this is the show where we talk to the bodybuilding legends themselves, and we also talk about the history of bodybuilding. And on today's episode, we've got two really special guests. Both of them are friends of mine. The first is Lonnie Tieper. And Lonnie has been in the bodybuilding industry for a long time as a journalist. He used to work for Iron Man magazine. He was their main guy there, their main columnist. And he also, of course, emceed many contests, including the Pro Iron Man Invitational and also the Arnold Classic for many, many years. Our other guest is Peter McGough. And Peter is also another excellent, one of the best bodybuilding journalists of our time. Peter used to work for Joe Weider's magazine, and he was the editor-in-chief of Flex magazine for many years. And then he went over and worked for Robert Kennedy and Muscle Mag International for Robert Kennedy passed away. And then he also went out and worked for Muscular Development. So both of these guys have been around the industry a very long time, and they really know what they're talking about. They've seen it all. They've done it all. So I brought them both on to talk about where the future of bodybuilding is going. And the reason I wanted to do this was because, of course, the mass monsters have dominated bodybuilding for the last 30 years. And we usually talk on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast about the years before that, the 1960s, the 1970s, the 1980s, when the more classical type of physiques were in vogue. And the bodybuilders were judged not just for their muscles, but also for their symmetry, their proportion, their posing ability. And now it seems like things are changing a little bit because we had Sean Roden win the Mr. Olympia last year in 2018, and he beat out Phil Heath, who has been dominating the Olympia for, I believe, 7 years in a row. And one of the reasons Sean beat Phil was because Phil has been had this pregnant-looking stomach the last couple of years. He's had some problems with his abdominals, the abdominal distension. And Sean, of course, has these incredible abs, very small waist. So everybody applauded that. They thought it was a great decision. And then this year at the Arnold Classic in Columbus, Ohio, which is the second biggest bodybuilding contest in the world behind the Olympia, Brandon Curry was the winner. Brandon also has a very classical type of physique with a small waist, a really good taper, and just excellent shape throughout his physique. And he was also voted the winner. So now we've got two guys who are more like the types of physiques that used to win back in the 80s, back in the golden days, back in the 70s. So I brought Lonnie and Peter on to discuss if they think that bodybuilding is going back to that. And we also discussed a lot of the older contests and how things used to be judged when Frank Zane was winning the Olympia, when Muhammad McAway used to win pro shows, when Samir Banoot and Chris Dickerson won the Olympia. So we're going to have a really interesting discussion between Lonnie and Peter. The discussion that we had went on for so long that we made it two parts. So today we will talk about part one. And I hope you guys enjoy it. We're sort of getting away from our usual format here on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, but I thought this was a really good discussion about bringing in what used to happen with bodybuilding in the golden era with what's happening now. All right. So emails from the Ken Sprag interview that we did last week. A lot of people really liked that interview, and I really liked it. Ken, a very well-spoken individual, very much like Charles Gaines was when I talked to him. So I really enjoyed talking to Ken. And we're going to get to those in a minute. But first, I want to mention that we are brought to you by our sponsor, Old School Labs. I've been with Old School Labs for several years now. This is the supplement company that draws on the wisdom of the golden era of fitness and bodybuilding to offer unique supplements for the discerning athlete. I'm talking no proprietary blends, no artificial flavors or sweeteners. You may have heard of their award-winning fat burner called Vintage Burn, which is the world's first muscle-preserving fat burner. Or Vintage Blast, which is the world's first two-stage pre-workout. Old School Labs is the only brand that I use, trust, and associate my name with. They're also the company that sponsors Breon Ansley, who is the 2017 and 2018 Classic Physique Olympia champion. They also sponsor 1983 Mr. Olympia Samir Banoot and bodybuilding legend Tom Platz, as well as the real deal Chris Cormier. So use the discount code LEGENDS12 and you will get 12% off your order when you go to oldschoollabs.com. Old School Labs, supplements that make sense. All right, what else is going on in the world of bodybuilding? We had a lot of birthdays this week. Rory Liedemeyer, who is one of the classic physiques from the 1980s, probably had his best appearance at the 1983 NPC Nationals when he took second place. And we actually talk a lot about Rory in our interview with Lonnie and Peter coming up. I think Rory celebrated his 63rd birthday, and he's still looking great. I've been in contact with Rory to try and get him on the show, but he's very hot and cold. You know, sometimes he says he's going to do it, and then he won't answer my emails, so I'll just keep trying. We also had Elaine LaLanne. She was married to Jack LaLanne for many, many years. She celebrated her 93rd birthday. So congratulations to Elaine LaLanne. She looks fantastic. She's on Facebook all the time and posting very inspirational videos. So it's always great to see someone like her. She's bringing up about the legacy of Jack LaLanne. She's living strong and healthy. So good for her. If you're a movie buff, they released the Quentin Tarantino trailer this week for his 9th movie called Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. And this looks really great. It takes place in 1969 in Hollywood, of course. And Leonardo DiCaprio plays an actor. And Brad Pitt plays a stuntman. I don't know if he's his stuntman or he just plays a stuntman. So it takes place, like I said, in 1969. This is right around the time when Charles Manson and his gang killed all those people in Hollywood. And one of the people they killed was Sharon Tate, who was an actress. In fact, if you're a bodybuilding fan, you remember that she was in a movie called Don't Make Waves, which starred Claudia Cardinale and Tony Curtis, but it also starred Dave Draper, Mr. America. So that's how I remembered Sharon Tate for the first time I heard of her. She was a very beautiful actress. And she was one of the people who was tragically killed by Charles Manson and his gang. In fact, she was like 8 months pregnant and they killed her and the baby. So this story, I guess, takes place around that. And Margot Kidder plays Sharon Tate in the movie. And what's really cool for me, being a Bruce Lee fan, is they also be playing Bruce Lee, because Bruce Lee was in Hollywood at the time and he was trying to make it, but he had a hard time because he was Chinese. And he was actually doing a lot of stunt work where he was teaching people how to fight in movies. I think he taught Dean Martin how to fight in one of the movies he made. James Coburn, who was also a student of his, and he taught Sharon Tate how to fight for one of the movies that she was in. So I think that's how he enters into this movie. So in the trailer that I saw, the guy who plays Bruce Lee, he looks just like him. It was kind of a short trailer, but I love Tarantino's movies. They're always a lot of fun. I think he's a genius director, so I can't wait to see this. This will be his 9th movie. And he said he's only going to do 10, so I hope this one really knocks it out of the park. What else is going on? I've been getting a lot of programs, a lot of people ordering my training and diet programs. So if you want to do that, I don't know if it's because spring is coming up or what's happening, but I think I got like 3 this week. So I'm very happy to help all these people out. You can just go to my website, which is called dadbod2ripbod.com, and that's the number 2, dadbod2ripbod.com. Or you can just email me, if that's easier for you, naturalolympia@gmail.com, and I will set you guys up on a training or diet program. I say guys, but guys or women, doesn't matter. My workouts have actually been kind of bad this week, or this month, I should say. Ever since March 1st started, I went to Colorado for that seminar, and I was so tired when I got back. I ended up taking a couple days off, so I ended up being off for a week, and then it's just kind of been off that I got back from Colorado. So hasn't been the greatest month, I've got to be honest, but I'm looking forward to getting it going in April. And I gained a little weight, had my birthday, and just going out eating too many times, drinking too many margaritas, and happens to all of us, and I got a little bit off track. So my waist is up more than I want it to be because I want to stay lean. So I am going to get back on track. I'm going to lose a good inch, maybe even an inch and a half. And actually, I'm going to start it tomorrow. I'm not going to wait till April. I'm going to start in March, get my workouts back on track. I'm going to do my deload week this week, so that'll be my rest week, and then I will start power cycle starting next Monday, which will be the first week of April. So I'm looking forward to getting back on track. That's how it goes. You can't really stay on track all the time, guys. Everybody has their ups and downs, and I had a sort of a down month this month. All right, so I wanted to read a few emails here, and thank you guys for sending them in. If you want to send any comments or questions or anything you have to say about the show, please email them to me at naturalolympia@gmail.com. All right, I got an email from Mario Strong. And Mario says, "Hey, John, I'm just writing to say that I've been immensely enjoying your interviews of our legends on your Bodybuilding Legends Show website. Your interviews are great because bodybuilding is in your heart and you give the interviewees time to fully express themselves. What you are doing is preserving our sports history for future generations to enjoy and learn from. And I was thinking that Leon Brown would be perfect for your show. Leon's images are sprinkled throughout the book Pumping Iron, and he was the first bodybuilder ever featured in Sports Illustrated and has appeared in the film Stay Hungry, amongst other things. To this day, he is still great friends with Arnold, and he has lots of stories about training at the original Gold's Gym. If you'd like to conduct an interview with him, please let me know. Thank you, Mario." Yes, Mario, that would be awesome. So I contacted Mario, of course, and I told him I would love to interview him. So we are supposed to do the interview this week with Leon Brown. So that will probably be coming up the week after next week, because next week we will have, of course, part two of our interview with Lonnie Tieper and Peter McGuff. So hopefully that will go through, and you guys will be hearing from Leon Brown in a couple of weeks. So thank you, Mario, for that. We appreciate that. I also got an email from Scott Barron, who is one of our big contributors. Scott is also a contributor to Patreon. If you guys wanted to contribute and help contribute to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast to keep the expenses down on my part, you can go to the Patreon link, which is on the upper right-hand corner of our website, bodybuildinglegendsshow.com. You can contribute $10 a month, whatever you want to contribute. So Scott has been doing this since the very beginning, so I really appreciate it. He's a great, great contributor to the show. "John, your interview with Ken Sprague was absolutely outstanding. That Mr. Sprague took the time to share his amazing contributions to the golden era of bodybuilding with the Legends of Bodybuilding audience. As you already know, I was fortunate enough to spend time with both Arnold and Joe Gold back in 1992. Needless to say, I'm a huge fan of both. That being said, I was surprised to learn that there was legal actions between Mr. Sprague against both Arnold and Joe Gold. Bottom line, Ken Sprague proved that he was extremely tough. This episode was thought-provoking, and I'm looking forward to listening to it again for a second time. Keep up the excellent work." All right. Thank you, Scott. James Koch said, actually, James sent a letter to Jerry Brano, and he copied me on it. And he said, "Hi, Jerry, a longtime subscriber here. I've always loved your work and your newsletter especially." He goes, "I'm just finishing listening to your last interview with John, the 1988 Bodybuilding Review episode. Just excellent stuff." He said, "John, I've been forwarding these podcasts to other who train with me starting in the 1980s in Oakland, the Olympia Health Club and Alameda Iron Island Gym, which was Clancy's gym back in the day in California. And now, while scattered, we still love to train. Robbie was there. Don Ross was around there as well as Lee Moran. Squat 1,000 pounds officially. I remember Lee Moran. Actually, I was one of Robbie's training partners in the early 80s, and I haven't talked to him in probably 10 years. I love those training sessions. Bam, bam, bam. Great memories. John, the stories you tell are fantastic. Just fantastic. Arnold throwing syringes at the dartboard. I busted out loud laughing. I can just see it. Too funny. And the current physique board shorts contestants. You don't even have to do squats. Ha, ha, ha. Jerry, you have quite a funny side to you. You should try to bring that out in your YouTube video somehow. It's very entertaining. Well, of course, I totally agree with you guys. The mass monsters killed the sport. Now they all look like identical gorillas. The 80s or an early 90s or before, they each had their unique style or look. Thus, regular guys could always find someone to aspire to try to look like. No more. Zip. Gone. Thus, the sport dies. Anyway, all the best to you guys. Keep up the great work, Jim." And I heard from Paul Thorpe and said, "Hi, John. As always, the shows are great. I just want to say the 80 Olympia documentary that Paul Graham filmed is also on eBay under the reissued title Total Rebuild as a play on the Arnold film title Total Recall. Depending on people's often extreme views on the competition, it may also be listed as a Much Ado About Nothing or a Crime of the Century. Sometimes you can get a version with the trailer of the 81 included in the deal, listed as The Eagle Was Swindled." I didn't know about that. All right, thank you, Paul. And another old friend of mine, Pat Comer, who is another big listener to the show, Pat wrote and he said, "Hi, John. Listen to your Ken interview and your conversation about Ken's ability to promote bodybuilding to popular culture reminded me of when I was taking a literature class in college in the early 80s. In my literature textbook, we studied an essay that Studs Terkel wrote from an interview he did with Arnold Schwarzenegger. I am attaching that essay thinking that it is a rare essay from that golden era age. If you like it, maybe you could read it in a future podcast. I really enjoy your podcasts that remember the Chicago bodybuilding scene. Lance Dreher, Bob Gary Strand, etc. stir up the great memories of Illinois bodybuilding. All right, and I read this article that Pat sent me, and I am going to read it after we have our interview with Lonnie and Peter McGuff. So stay tuned after our interview, and I am going to read it. It was a really excellent interview with Arnold. And like I said, this had to be in the early 80s, as Pat said. It looked like it was right after Arnold retired from bodybuilding. It sounds like when he was trying to get in his movie career. So it's a great insight into Arnold's mental attitude. You guys are really going to love it. So it's kind of long, so I'm not going to read it now. We'll get to our interview first, and then I will read it as soon as our interview is all over. You think you're really going to like it. All right, and before we get to our interview with Peter McGuff and Lonnie Tieper, I also want to mention that we are also brought to you by Florida Alternative Medicine, where age is just a number. If you want to feel great, optimize your energy levels, burn fat, and balance your hormone levels to maximize your potential, then go see the experts at Florida Alternative Medicine and Weight Loss. Their certified staff and knowledgeable staff will work with you to achieve your goals and get you the results that you've been looking for. They offer a wide range of services that ensure you will not only look and feel amazing, but also be comfortable knowing that they're there for you every step of the way. Their competitive pricing, along with their quality products and services, are just a few reasons to give them a call. You can call them at their office number in Tampa, Florida, which is 813-922-8939. They will work with anybody in the continental United States, talk to you either over the phone or by Skype. So again, call them at 813-922-8939. Or if it's easier, you can go to their website, which is flalternativemeds.com. FL for Florida, alternativemeds.com. Tell them that you heard their ad on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and they will give you a free consultation plus 20% off your order. And don't forget to mention the magic pill. This is developed and backed by science. It's a formula that was made by chemists and expert formulators who are working with Florida Alternative Medicine. It's a revolutionary fat-burning product, and it's getting rave reviews from athletes all over the country. So you can order a month's supply of the magic pill by calling that number, 813-922-8939. It's a fat loss pill and thermogenic, and it costs $39.99. So just call Florida Alternative Medicine and order theirs. All right, that is our opening for the show. And here is our interview with Lonnie Tieper and Peter McGuff, where we talk about where the future of bodybuilding is going and where it has been. Hope you enjoy it. Here you go. All right, welcome back to the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And I have two very special guests on the line today, two friends of mine. The first is Lonnie Tieper, and this is Lonnie's first time on the show. And Lonnie is a bodybuilding journalist, has been in the business for many, many years. He worked for Ironman magazine, and he was an MC with the Arnold Classic and the Pro Ironman Invitational. And my other guest is Peter McGuff, and Peter is also a bodybuilding journalist who has been in the business for many, many years. He used to work for Joe Weider's magazine, and then for a time he worked for Muscle Mag International and also Muscular Development. And today we are going to talk about where bodybuilding is going in the future and where it's been. So welcome to the show, guys. Great to have you both here.
Thank you.
Well, making predictions is always hard, especially when it's about the future.
Right.
I think if we went back 10 years, we had no idea that men's physique or the classic would come in like they did, and the bikini has grown substantially since then. You know, I think we're in a bit of a morass at the moment. I appreciate that maybe they're going to start, you know, with Sean Roden looking for more symmetry conditioning. But the problem is that the guys that have come into the top ranks over the last few years haven't been attaining that look. You know, the Rollies, the big Rammies and everything. But mm-hmm. It's too late for them to turn back. So if we're going to get a change, we're going to have to wait for some new guys coming in who start off with a Sean Roden or a Sean Ray or somebody like that as a physique ideal, not, you know, get as heavy as you can. So it's pretty difficult to say, and the landscape has changed enormously. You know, I think the Olympia is because it's so big, and the Arnold, it's taken away from the bodybuilding, and coupled with the demise of the magazines, we're not able to build stars in the way that we did, you know, put them on covers. It's all right, you know, having your say on social media, but it's not the same as, you know, being in a glossy magazine and your personality being established mm-hmm. by people like Lonnie writing about them and digging in for the stuff. So I think the star power has gone down a little bit and will go down a little bit. You know, I just see that's the way I see it at the moment. It's not sour grapes about the magazine. It's just, at this point in time, I see you have to wait for a new batch of guys to get in.
Yeah, one of the reasons I wanted to have the show was because of recent results with the Olympia, and we had Sean Roden beating Phil Heath, and of course, Phil Heath has had that abdominal problem, the stomach distension over the last couple of years. So I didn't think Phil Heath was going to be beaten until he retired, so that was kind of a surprise. And then we just had Brandon Curry win the Arnold Classic a couple of weeks ago, and he's another guy who's got that real good V taper and the smaller waist. So I was just wondering, are we headed away now from the mass monsters back to more of the symmetry and proportion like we used to have in bodybuilding?
I'm not so sure about that. Those two guys, you know, Sean did win the Olympia, Brandon did win the Arnold, and they're great bodybuilders. But the question is, did they win because of their exceptional shape and conditioning? Or was it that the person that they beat really wasn't at that same level? Like Phil Heath, for example, you mentioned, yeah, he had the problem with the midsection. Mm-hmm. As much as I like Sean Roden's physique, a beautiful physique without question, Phil Heath really beat himself. I don't know what the problem is with the midsection. Sean won from the front, but Phil Heath still definitely won from the back. Supposedly, he had a couple surgeries. He had some hernias or something. And as far as Brandon Curry, that could have gone either way probably, but maybe he's just better than William Bonac. I don't know if it's so much. I wrote a story for bodybuilding.com and we did title it Mass versus Class or something to that effect. So I can understand your point. But as Peter brought up, we have classic bodybuilding that's come in now. And there's still a lot of these fans. I think the people who go to the Olympia still want to see these big, giant guys. I mean, it doesn't bother them that the belly sticks out, I guess. You know, it's like in sports, you know, you want to see somebody better than the person before you, the guy that broke the 100-meter record and ran 9.86. Then you want to see a guy run 9.79, mm-hmm. and then 9.72. And so I don't know if you know, if that's really the answer. Did they win because we've changed directions? Or did they win because they just happened to be better than that other person that day?
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree with Donnie. I mean, I think you can make a case for Phil winning last year. I mean, give Sean, you know, the front shots, apart from most muscular. You take the absent thighs, double biceps. But after that, it's Phil's game with all that thickness and roundness and detail. It's difficult to say. I mean, you know, Phil had a couple of close tweaks. Maybe it was a case of saying, you know, we're looking for improvement, and it's been 2 or 3 years now that stomach's always been there. And I also agree that it could have gone either way with William and Brandon. You know, if William had just been a little bit sharper, it might have been a different story. But, you know, it's great to see guys like Brandon and Sean win. But as I say, it's early days yet. We'll have to see. And the Classic, if we're going to do that, then I wrote something when Classic came out. Why did we have to have Classic physique? Mm-hmm. That's the way it always should be. You know?
Right.
Those proportions, that balance, that flow, the lines, not just mass for mass sake and you know, rib glutes and what have you. But, you know, Lonnie's right. People go to the circus. They go to see the lions and tigers. They don't go to see the hamsters, you know. So they'll always be that.
The hamsters. Yeah, well, as one fan wrote me, he goes, heck with the sissies. You know, let's bring the real men. You know, yeah. Some people just, like I said, a distended stomach is no big deal to somebody who's a yeah. fan that likes to see a guy yeah. 5'11", 285 pounds. In pretty good condition. So, you know, it's all a matter of what you like. And now that you have another division that supposedly has all these traits that we should have had in the first place, as Peter pointed out, some people are saying, let them go in the bodybuilding.
That's it. And I didn't mean to refer to the classic guys as hamsters. I'm just drawing a correlation between looking at larger-than-life characters and other characters that aren't as large. But, you know, the classic, a lot of the contests, especially the qualifiers I've seen, is it's difficult for the judges to be judging men's open. Just to go back a bit, you know, what you were saying, Lonnie, it almost was like, okay, bring the classic in. This is for you guys who like, you know, the symmetry and all the rest of it. You were the guys in the open, just go for it. You know, do whatever you want, be as freaky as possible. It was a green light for that. But I see some of the classic contests, and I've seen guys with much better shape, balance, flow, and good condition lose out to guys who are ripped but don't have the same structure or as good a structure. I think that's got to be tweaked a little or looked a bit more. You know, what is the priority? It's the whole package, obviously. But, you know, we've got to a point in bodybuilding, and it started in the 90s, really, with, I don't know, people like Flex Wheeler and Troy Alves being marked down because they didn't have ripped glutes. It's like, when did it become a ripped glute contest? You know, I mean, that's, to me, the only cut in your buttocks would be the functional one that's there, you know, that we're all born with. It's hitching the shorts up and everything. And then the stupid ass backwards thing to it is, like Lonnie said, the abs are allowed to be distended, but the the other side of the torso has to be ripped.
Right. Lonnie, you just mentioned sports. It's like progress in sports. And that was one of my questions and one of my ideas for doing the show was looking back at bodybuilding and what is supposed to be, what is bodybuilding? I mean, do we define progress as getting bigger and bigger and bigger? Or should that symmetry and proportion and shape always be a factor? Like, if you look back at the contest of the 70s and the 80s, that was always a big factor with the judges, as well as posing. And now that seems to have gone away.
Well, you know, you got two ways to look at it. I mean, yes, obviously those traits are something we're looking for in a champion. But what happens if you have a guy that is superior in those areas, but he's half the size of the guy next to him? And when they start doing the mandatory poses, he gets swallowed up. You know, you almost have two different versions of a champion, one standing by himself and one standing next to somebody 60 or 70 pounds heavier. It still has pretty good shape and good conditioning. May not have the shape of the smaller person. And again, you know, I come from a sports writing background originally, and, you know, I never thought I'd see anybody better than Michael Jordan. Well, I think LeBron James is more gifted physically than Jordan. Now we got this kid, Zion Williamson from Duke, who may be better than both of them down the road. I mean, people are just expecting bigger and better and faster.
Yeah. But if you go back to the 70s and you look at Muhammad McAway, 5'2", 160 pounds, he could beat someone like Lee Haney, or Samir Banu could beat someone like Bertel Fox, because they were looking for all those factors. And now, can we ever go back to that? Because now the guys have gotten so big over the last, you know, 20 years or so. Can we go back to where they judge symmetry and proportion, and a smaller guy could beat a big guy? Or is that why they had to create Classic and just go to a whole different division?
Well, that's the reason they had to create 202 class, which grew into the 212, wasn't it? I mean, you go back to the 70s and distended midsections were not a problem unless your girlfriend was pregnant. You know, it's like Arnold.
That's a line,
you know,
of the week.
In essence, he didn't have the best overall symmetry, but he had, you know, those sloping shoulders combined with the best biceps and chest ever, in my opinion. Dramatic waist taper. The shots he used to hit, you know, fitted his physique to a T. And it was dramatic to look at. Sergio had that same wow factor, and the shape of people like Serge Nubre, Frank Zane, Robbie, Danny Padilla, Boya Ko. You know, the funny thing is, when you think of those guys, they all had a different look.
Yeah.
You could easily guess them from the silhouettes. You know, you might not be able to do that so easy today.
Right.
Yeah, you know, you brought up Frank Zane, and I remember meeting Frank Zane at Cal State LA in 1975. I just got hired there as sports information director, and he was taking classes there, and this guy was walking around, And I said, God, he kind of looks like Frank Zane, but he barely looks like he lifts weights. So I went up and I was eating a big banana split. And I said, are you Frank Zane? And he said, yeah. And he was asking me about the school weight room. And I said, well, I really don't work out here. I just concentrate on my nutrition. I had this, you know, giant banana split. But I went to do an article on him for the school newspaper, and he wasn't there that day. And a couple of students said, you're looking for Frank? And I said, yeah. And they go, why? Well, I'm going to do an interview with him. At that time, he hadn't won the Olympia yet. It was 75. But I think he won the universe and had beaten Arnold at one point. He may have beaten him at that point. I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And they go, oh, yeah, he kind of looks like he works out. You know, and the reason I'm bringing that up is Frank Zane, you look at him walking down the street or even maybe walking onto the stage, you think, what is he doing here? And then when he starts posing, all kinds of things start happening. So how do you say really who has a better physique? You know, this guy versus that guy. It's subjective. And you do have these guidelines, but sometimes, you know, other things overtake that. It's a big overpowering guy. I remember this friend of mine, he was not a Frank Zane fan, and I was. And every time Frank would win the Olympia, which was 3 years in a row, he'd leave a message and say, well, that skinny guy won the Olympia again. You know, he just thought that, you know, to be Mr. Olympia, you needed to be a big, huge guy. And Frank was probably 5'9", 180 pounds, 185 pounds. Samir, you mentioned, and when he won the Olympia in 83, was probably 180 pounds. But, you know, there weren't too many people ever better than that physique in 1983.
No, I mean, he was symmetry personified that year. And then, you know, you had, like you say, Muhammad McAwee, 170 pounds, two Olympia runner-up spots.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of ended a run of, after Arnold, there wasn't really a big man won the Olympia until Lee Haney came along. And, of course, then you had a first really big man with mass and balance since Arnold. And he of course, takes the Olympia in eight occasions. But you had other, you know, these were all symmetrical guys, very symmetrical. Bob Paris and, you know, Paul Dillette until it all went wrong with injuries and stuff. Sonny Schmidt.
Barry DeMay, yeah.
Miloš, Porter, Cottrell. You know, and of course everybody, you know, blames the mass chase on Dorian when he came along. But, you know, in 92 he was chiseled. He was too light for him. He took off too much. He admitted it because with Haney not being there, he felt his main challenge was going to be Sean Ray, and he'd have to out-condition him, so he didn't need the size. And then, of course, when he came through in 93, he just rewrote the rule book of mass, and I'll say symmetry. And after that, of course, things went a little bit different for him, but he was 257 in 93 and 260 in 97, so he wasn't whacking on massive size.
Tell you, I emceed that 93 Mr. Olympia. That was the first show Olympia that I emceed. And I saw him walking backstage, and it was hard to fathom what I was looking at. This guy was so chiseled, but thick. He was big. He was symmetrical. And he wasn't happy with me because, you know, I used to do the predictions in my column, News and Views and Ironman, on the Olympia. And I thought he was going to win easily. But, you know, to be stupid, try to be entertaining, I picked somebody else. You know, you don't think about it when you're right that anybody's looking at this other than you. So when I saw him backstage, I go, God, you look unbelievable. And he says, well, why didn't you write that in your column? And I said, well, what do you mean? He goes, well, I cut your column out. You didn't predict me to win. And I stuck it on my refrigerator. And every time I walked by, I thought of you before I went and did my training. And I said, well, I'm really glad I'm contributing to your win. Can I have some of the money? But, you know, that was a guy that was big. It was hard to even imagine to me at that point of somebody looking like that. I wasn't at Helsinki, I believe, in 92. But in 93, I don't know, Peter may agree or disagree, I think that was the best Dorian Yates we've ever seen. And what, it was about 5'10", 5'11", 200, you said 257?
Yeah, I actually think that I mean, 94 was a bit of a disaster because he had the arm. And
he had the injuries,
and everything, you know, the stomach started to bloat that year. But 93 was the year he walked out and everybody went, what the F, you know, I've never seen anything like that. He came back in 95 determined to, you know, resurrect himself from 94. And I've discussed it with him many times. I think that was his best overall in terms of mass. He had a bit more condition. But we'd already seen him in 93, so we didn't see it as a big jump forward. But I think overall, 95 in the last time in Atlanta was would be my choice. But yeah, 93 was... I just remember everybody... I mean, in that contest, you know, unfortunately, Flex Wheeler didn't come in as good as he was earlier in the year. But they compared Sean, Flex, and Dorian in the symmetry round. Remember, they had the symmetry round first. The right. muscularity round, they called out Sean, Flex, and somebody else, left Dorian alone. And then the head judge, it would be Mannion at the time, said, we've done, he said to Wayne D'Amelio, that's it, we've done, you're not going to compare Dorian. Wayne called Dorian out for the crowd to be compared with Sean Ray, just to, you know, to give them a show and see where it was. But, you know, it was like Sammy Benoit said Dorian was first, second, and third. And
I know everybody yeah, well, there's an example of somebody with great shape, Sean Ray, going against a guy so much bigger, so much over, yeah. you know, so much, he just overpowered him. I mean, when you start when they start doing the mandatories, then you could really see the difference. You see Sean Ray standing by himself. You go, geez, who's going to beat this guy? And then this beast comes out there, you know, like made out of rock.
Lonnie, I'm glad you mentioned Sean Ray. I just heard an interview with him a week or two ago on some other internet station. And he was talking about that 94 Olympia. And he said, you know, he thought that was his best. And he thought he should have beat Dorian, of course. But, I mean, now, if you would take that 94 Olympia and go back 10 years or 20 years, would the results have been different? Did the judging standards change from, like, the mid-80s to the mid-90s, where if you had a guy like Dorian, a big guy, who maybe doesn't have the symmetry and shape that a Flex Wheeler has or Sean Ray has, but he's a little bit off like he was in 94. Would he be able to beat a guy like Sean Ray back in the 70s or back in the 80s? Or would the judges have said, no, symmetry is so much more important, proportion is more important, so we're going to give it to, you know, the guy who has a more symmetrical physique?
I don't think Yates' symmetry was that bad. I think he was very symmetrical for a large guy. I'm not saying it was better than Sean Ray's. Flex Wheeler, I think, had the nicest shape ever, but I think people underestimate Yates's shape back in the early 90s. You really look at those, you start to do the comparisons. 94 is a different story. He had the muscle tears, and, you know, that was a debatable decision, in my opinion, because of that. But I tell you, 90.
It wouldn't have surprised me if Sean had won.
In 94?
I feared the worst. In 94, I feared the worst. I thought,
Or Lavroni, Sean Ray or Kevin Lavroni in 94. Lavroni was right there, too.
Yeah, but my recollection is I was thinking if it's going to go to somebody, it's going to go to somebody else, it's going to go to Sean Ray.
Yeah, but I think it was a unanimous decision, so... The judges didn't have too much of a problem with it. And I think what it comes down to is when, again, you put somebody by himself versus somebody next to another person who's a lot larger, you see the major difference. So, and it's all subjective. You know, it's not a 100-meter dash where who hits the tape first. It's opinion.
But, I mean, that was in the 90s, and one of Sean's big complaints about the Olympia back in those years was it was the same judges all the time. So if you would have had a different set of judges, or the way the judges looked at it maybe in the 70s, would they have not given it to Dorian? Because, like, Sean was complaining that in the symmetry round, Dorian still took first place when he obviously had the bicep tear, his stomach was a little bloated that year. So why should he have won the symmetry round? It seemed like to me, like when Frank Zane was winning the Olympia, the judges took into consideration symmetry, proportion. That's why Frank Zane, at 185, 190 pounds, was able to beat bigger guys like Mike Mentzer or Cal Scalak or
They had Robin. The same judges every year then, too. So you could look at it the other way. Well, Frank won 3 years in a row because they had the same judging panel.
Right.
So it's hard to say, you know.
Yeah. I think every...
Sean Ray's got a point. You know, he's got a point that the same... I remember at the press conference one year, he goes, I got the same people judging me every year.
Right.
There's no way I can finish higher than, you know, fourth or fifth, which he did 4 or 5 years in a row, 6 years in a row. I think he was in the top five for 12 years.
Yeah, but, 12 or 13.
Yeah, but you know what? Some people feel that bodybuilding is still about size. Mm-hmm. Our major portion is about size. It depends on who's viewing it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, it's called bodybuilding, not bodybuilding.
Yeah, it's not.
I mean, it's just gone over the last couple of weeks now. It's guys used to be in shape. You know, we could, in the flex days, you know, in the 90s, you could shoot a guy, you know, 4 or 5 days out from a contest before they started carving up, and he'd be in shape for maybe 5 or 6 days afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
As we progressed, if you could use the word, you know, unless you caught a guy the morning after the contest, you know, you couldn't get him, and even then sometimes it didn't work out. I remember, 2002 Olympia, you know, the gurus had come in, and it was all about what we do at 11 o'clock and, you know, spin round, sing Yankee Doodle Dandy and take this pill and everything's going to be all right, you know. And there was one of the gurus, prejudging was supposed to start at 12, and there was a big long delay. It was 12:45, and he was screaming because my guy was ready at 12, now it's 45 minutes later, and he's losing it. You know, I'm not going to... You know, that's a true story. I'm not going to embarrass anybody by saying who it was. I'll tell you privately. But so, it just brought it home to me. My God, we've gone... I used to go on the European tours in the 80s and 90s. You'd hang out with the guys. You'd bond with them because you were going from hotel to hotel. Stupid itineraries were to get to London from Madrid. You'd go to Frankfurt, then to Oslo, and then to London because the tickets were cheaper. It was hard on the bodybuilders. We used to talk, but they used to talk about, yeah, getting ready for a contest. But it was more on what they did dietary-wise. It wasn't drugs. Mm-hmm. You know, they never really talked about them because they were all using the same thing anyway. But as the years went by, you know, you can sit at the Arnold and there's amateur bodybuilders on the next table and they're talking about what they have to do in the last 2 days or what cycle they're going to be on, how long will they be on, should be on that amount, you know, and it's like nobody's doing bicep curls anymore, you know, it's just, I know I sound like an old fart, I am, you know, to live through the 70s, 80s, 90s, like me and Lonnie did, it was a golden era, but maybe, you know, because we were younger and the sport was growing, we didn't know where it was going, but, you know, the physiques were sort of more attainable. And
right.
You had characters. This is what I come back to. It's like, you know, Joe used to sign all the guys in the 90s after WBF. So we had exclusive rights. I never liked that, Lonnie. I wanted everybody to be able to shoot everybody. Because you could do it in them days. The guys could be in shape for 3 or 4 photo shoots. But you'd get a guy come along, Kevin Leveroni, right? Listen, you very quickly realize he's a different character. You know, he ends up interviewing you and going off in tangents and everything and coming back. So that's the way you didn't garnish him, but that's you portrayed his personality. You know, Porter was the good old boy. You know, Bertle was a loner. You built those characters up. And the thing was,
Sean Ray was a Jack Benny of bodybuilding.
Yeah, yeah, and you let him run.
You always forgot his wallet.
Exactly. If that was the only thing that was tied to the new skin, was the wallet. But, you know, you established them as a character that could only be followed in the magazines. And if they did say something stupid, you'd offer not say. Sometimes you're looking for the gossip. You say, do you really want to say that? Whereas now they go on and sometimes they contradict themselves and get into a rhyme. And nobody, you don't pick something up now and really learn who this guy is. There's
right.
interviews after the show, but the guy just wants to go and eat anyway, a 10-minute interview. But when you do a 2,000-page feature and feature the guy 3 or 4 times a year, you build his persona as it is. But, you know, Sean Ray became, like you say, the loud mouth. And, yeah, we always joked about him never paying for a meal. You know, Dorian was this guy that didn't live in America, kept to himself, very quiet, then just came out, never punched the air when he won. You know, there was none of that jumping up and down. So, you know, Charles Clermont is a laid-back guy from London who, you know, he'd get a bad result. He'd say, well, Pete, at the end of the day, nobody died, did they? That was always his favourite thing, you know. And, you know, all those guys were around. Paul Dillard, you know, what a freak he was the first couple of years he came in, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So Mike Quinn was the, you know, the...
Oh, he was on that job. funny, though.
Yeah.
So the bad boy of bodybuilding. He was...
Yeah.
He was something else. Mike Quinn was something else. And another thing, you know, back in when we had the Ironman Pro, not even to mention the Arnold or the Olympia, just the lineups, the quality that we had in the Ironman Pro was unbelievable. I mean, Ronnie Coleman entered the show 1 year, got third. Sean won the first one, but then came back later, and I think he got third or fifth, maybe even fifth. We had Vince Taylor, Flex Wheeler won it 4 or 5 times. Cormier, Lila Barada.
Phil Heath won it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Phil Heath won. I mean, the lineups were unbelievable. Now, to me, it's really watered down compared to what it used to be because of various factors.
And that's another thing that, you know, is in my mind that it's like the open men's bodybuilding to me. There's too many pros coming in who aren't up to it. It's diluted the pro lineups. We're not getting guys entering contest after contest because there's no big sponsorship about for bodybuilders. So they're not being signed an agreement with the sponsor. Oh, you've got to compete twice a year or whatever. They haven't got the money to enter these. So spectator attendance is down. So sometimes you look around and you know, pre-judgings used to be packed, and they're not anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's all, you know, being a bit marginalized. You know, all the sponsor opportunities are going to more attainable physiques, the men's physique guys. You know, that's what the ordinary guy who's not really interested in bodybuilding, he wants to go down the clubs and hit on the women. That's what he wants to look like.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you made a good point, Peter, talking about it. That was, if you look at the physiques from the 70s and 80s, those physiques were more attainable. And, you know, we talk about progress in bodybuilding, and a lot of it, I think the drugs have changed. The drugs have increased, or I don't know what they're taking, but the physiques have definitely gotten much, much bigger. And now the physiques are not as attainable. And maybe that has to do with, you know, the popularity of the open men dropping off a little bit. You know, we talk about these guys, everybody wants to see the monsters, but the physiques now are so overblown that I think a lot of regular people can't relate to them as much.
Yeah.
You know, another thing too is in the old days, what we call the olden days, the 80s and the 90s, we didn't have as many shows are going to be better because the opportunities are less. There's fewer opportunities. Yeah. So you're seeing the top people. I remember the first year I emceed the Olympia. That was, I also did the Ironman and the Night of Champions, the old Night of Champions, the San Francisco Pro. And I think one other show, that's about all we had at that time. So every lineup was stacked.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now you have, what, 25 or 30 shows? I just threw that number out there. I may be way off, but there's a lot of them out there. And if you have that many shows, you're going to have 3 or 4 times as many guys competing in the
Let's talk about the posing. Now, I don't know what year it was, but they stopped judging the posing round. And we all know bodybuilding used to be a lot about the posing. Yesterday was Rory Liedelmeyer's birthday, and I looked up an old video from the 1983 NPC Nationals where he took second to Bob Paris. And I reposted his posing routine from that show, and I put it on YouTube. And I watched it again. It was just amazing. It wasn't the most technically perfect posing routine, but he had such a connection with the audience, and the music that he used and the ovation he got at the end of it was amazing. You just don't see that kind of connection with the audience that Rory had at that one. And like Muhammad McAway used to do, and Ed Corney, of course, used to do. So how much of that has affected the way bodybuilding has changed? Because we don't judge the posing anymore, and the bodybuilders don't work on the posing as much.
You know, one of the best Olympias I've ever seen was the 1988 Olympia.
I agree.
It was like a perfect storm. You know, it came to Los Angeles, the home of bodybuilding. Goals was the hallowed ground. You'd walk in there. I got there like 10 days before the show. You walk in there and you see Rich Gaspari. All the East Coasters had flown out. The homegrown guys were there. Sean would come up once a week. Gary Striden was in there. Mike Quinn, Berry DeMay, Buchanan, Labrada, Robbie. Then you'd go across the worlds and Bob Paris would be there with Ralph Moller, who entered. Tom Platz was there, but he'd stopped competing and was streamlined, and he was doing that Road to the Olympia video. But the posing from just about everybody in that contest was out of this world. I still look back on it. And, you know, Bob Paris, how can you forget him posing to Tracy Chapman, Baby Can I Hold You, where he ends up with him lying on the floor, feigning sleep. The audience went nuts. And that was just about the time you interviewed him, isn't it? It was before that that he came out.
I did the Bob Paris interview. His basically his coming out interview was 1989. It was a year after
that. Oh, was that right? Yeah.
I interviewed him and wrote the piece in April, and I think it came out in the June issue of 89, June or July.
Right.
But that was a year also. It was great because we had the weigh-ins and they came in with the boxing robes on. And I was sitting next to J.M. Mannion and I was predicting the weights from my seat. And I put everybody about 10 pounds less than what they said they were. And I was almost accurate on every one of them. And that's where I kind of came up with, well, whatever they tell you their weight is, they're 10 pounds lighter.
Right.
But it depends on when they weighed themselves. You know, if you have seven or eight meals in a day and you're fully clothed and you weigh yourself at night, you're going to be 10 or 12 pounds heavier than you are the next morning.
Yeah.
So I think the weight thing.
It was what he said was Haney. He said he was around 244 and that's when he came in. But there was others in there. I remember Barry DeMay, Mike Quinn, others. Stride.
Yeah, well, Stridham said he was 240 something. He was 229. Lee LeBron came in at 175.
Yeah, they all came in a lot lighter than they said, you know. But to me, that was, you know, get the video. You know, you never see, even Mike Quinn did a fantastic routine.
Yeah.
You know, upbeat, you know.
You know, it's Peter, it's funny you mentioned Mike Quinn. That same year, I emceed my first ever NPC show. It was in Holland, Michigan, put on by the late Donna Oliveira's husband. And Mike Quinn was the guest poser in July, and he was probably, I don't know, 8 to 10 weeks before the Olympia, and he was like 260 pounds. And I'm thinking, this guy's just, he's going to take dead last. And he went on this mission here. He like basically killed himself with a diet. He weighed in at 204 and a half. And I remember helping him up the, you know, Universal's got the hills and everything. Yeah. After prejudging, him and his girlfriend at the time and myself had to help him up the hill to get him to a restaurant to get something in him. I mean, he sucked down. I don't think he ever looked better.
Right.
But, that was his best ever,
That was his best, and I agree with Peter, what a spectacular show that was. Just the whole environment, you know, the Universal Studios and Amphitheater and Southern Cal and Bright Sunshine, and it was, you know, you think back and go, well, those were the days, huh?
Yeah, and I remember Phil Hill, he wasn't really in great shape, but he did that Phantom of the Opera routine. Again, nobody puts that amount of effort in today. You know, I was on the NPC Council in 2009 when they voted to drop posing as a scoring round. There was only me and a Polish judge argued for it. You know, they felt it was, how can you judge it? I've always had this argument with Bob Ciccarello. It's another way for the judges to look at a physique, see it from different angles. They play to the strengths and everything. If it's not going to be judged, why have the posing routine? We'll just have a straight through show and we all get home for 6 o'clock in the evening. Yet to me, it's like you don't have the Super Bowl, play the first two halves, and then after halftime, come out and the guys run up and down doing drills for 15 minutes. has no effect on the score. You know, what's the point?
Right.
And that is aligned with, I think, the drop-off in posing. Why do we bother? You know, do we have to catch the eye? We're already been given our placings. Let's save a bit of energy if we make the pose down. And I think that's a lot to do with it. And I told so many guys, it's like, why do you pick tunes that nobody knows? You like them. It's some, you know, esoteric artist you like, but you should choose a tune, a dramatic, powerful soundtrack that everybody knows. They come along with it then, they say, in a minute it's going to go way high, and that's when he's going to hit his best shot. You know, you bring them into it rather than all this clanging, bash, wallop, you know, that's going on with no synchronicity between the music and the poses.
Right. Well, you just mentioned Bob Paris.
The bodybuilders used to get upset with me because I'd write and say, well, the posing routine was just a regurgitation of the prejudging round.
Yeah.
They'd go and hit mandatory poses, but to music.
Yeah.
It's the same thing, but it's the music this time. They're
well,
individual
like said,
music.
Peter, you just mentioned Bob Paris, and you remembered what song he used at that 88 Olympia. And we can remember a lot. Like, I remember Barry DeMay posed to U2. This is 30 years later. I still remember the songs they used, you know.
Yeah.
And Sean Ray posed to Luther Vandross, remember, when he won that first Ironman in 1990. I remember those songs, and I remember those routines because it made such an impression. Because it was so, you know, so memorable from what they did.
Yeah.
You know, John, it's interesting that you mentioned Roy Liedlmeyer. Mm-hmm. I worked out at the same gym that he did in 1983. It was called Astro Gym in San Gabriel. And he had the hugest legions of fans you've ever seen. He'd wear the do-rag, and everybody else would wear the do-rag. You know, and it's funny that you mentioned in the 83 posing routine, because and the guy was as charismatic as you probably could get, and he had a phenomenal physique, and the battle against Paris, I think, was a one-point decision. Could have gone either way. But I thought the posing, as dramatic as it was in spots, was a little jerky in spots.
Yeah.
You come to one point and think, okay, now what am I going to do? What do I do next?
Yeah.
But he was so charismatic and smooth the way he did it that he was able to get away with that. And
that was one of the great battles of all.
Yeah, you remember the top five in that 83 Nationals. Paris beat Rory, I think, by one point. Mike Christian, who wasn't happy with the decision, was third. Matt Mendenhall was fourth. As great as he was too smooth. And a kid named Rich Gaspari was fifth. That was quite a lineup. That's before they had the super heavyweight. So
right,
Richie was fifth in the heavyweight. So what a battle that was at the Nationals. And I don't know if I can remember. Well, actually, the 91 Nationals wasn't too shabby either. I think Peter was there, where Lavroni beat Wheeler by a point, and Paul DeMeo, the late Paul DeMeo, was third.
Yeah.
And I think Ronnie Coleman was fourth, and Mendenhall was fifth.
Right. You got it.
I think I'm correct in that. I mean, but we've had some – those are big guys with some nice shape, too. You know,
But just
they
think today,
had
all those guys you're talking about, Liedlmeyer,
who turned 63 yesterday.
Liedlmeyer, Matt Mendenhall, Edgar Fletcher, they'd have all been pros if the same qualifications standards stood today.
Well, that's interesting that you mentioned that too, Peter, because we have I'm part of it's called Alhambra High School Hall of Fame Selection Committee, and I emceed that the last several years. And I tried to get John Arneda in for several years, who was Rory's training partner. And he finally got in last time. And as I explained when I introduced him, if we had the same standards then that we have now, John Arneda would have got his pro card in 1983.
Yeah.
And he never got his pro card. He was second at the Nationals twice, where he would have got his pro card. And then he won his class at the USA in 87, where Mike Quinn beat him for the overall.
Right.
Ironically, Mike Quinn beat Arneda for the Teenage Nationals overall title as well. But
well, that's right.
Johnny would have been a pro, you know, and he just kind of faded into the sunset.
That's right.
Because he didn't win the overall at the USA or his class at the Nationals.
And look at Bob Ciccarello. It took him 13 years or 13 tries before he got a pro card. And to do it, he had to win the overall at the USA.
He had to win the overall at the USA. Yeah, he was second, I think, in 99 to King Kamali in the heavyweight class. Then he came back, and I actually thought Bob probably should have won the class. Nothing yeah. against Kamali, but I thought Bob was a little more balanced. But he came back yeah. and won the next year, and yeah, he was 34 years old. He's been competing since he's been like 10.
Yeah.
he's been around a long time, but he kept yeah. to it. And there was a guy, talk about perseverance, there was times where he'd a couple shows he didn't even make the top 10 or the top 15, and some people yeah. thought he was through, but he kept on coming back. And in 99, I was really impressed with his improvement and was not shocked that he won the USA the next year. But that's a hard thing to have to win the overall to get a pro card. You know, it's a little easier now.
Yeah, well, you know, they all had to do it, didn't they? Leveroni had to.
Yeah, I did an interview.
The overall of the USA, you know, only the nationals, the champions. But I don't think they let lightweights through. Light or bantamweights, I can't remember now.
Yeah, they actually offered them the card, too.
I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with, or a couple of months ago actually, with Phil Williams. You remember that? Got named Lonnie and
I saw
Peter.
Phil at the Fit Expo out here in LA, first time in 20 years.
Yeah, here's a guy who won the overall at the USA, and then the next year he won the overall at the Nationals. But back then you had to go to the Universe and win your class at the Universe, and he took second to Gromulus at the 85 Universe. So he never turned pro. He waited 3 years till he turned pro because he just felt he wasn't good enough. And this is a guy who won the overall at the USA and the Nationals.
Jeez. He was a hell of a bodybuilder, Phil Williams.
Yeah, he sure was.
I'll tell you a guy that I thought was great, and Peter mentioned him earlier in this podcast, is Charles Claremont. I thought that guy had a great combination of size, shape, you know, density, presentation. And I figured, I don't know much about this game because I got this guy way at the top of every lineup that I see him, and he wasn't finishing that way.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, he was at his best when he was with NABBA and he won those three Pro Universe titles. And he was persuaded into the IFBB, and there was always this rivalry. Oh, you won't get a first shape. I do think he got a first shape for the most part. They didn't kill him. But I think he was more passionate 5 years earlier, you know, when he really pulled out all the stops. If you see the shots from 88, 89, 90, NABBA Universe, it was a tad better than, I think his best year was 93 when he won a load of contests on the Grand Prix Tour, beating mm-hmm. the Lebronian people. But yeah, he was another one who was overlooked, the same sort of Thierry Pastel. I thought that guy was beauty from head to foot.
He needed to work his arms a little more.
And
he had 22-inch arms.
He turned posing, and even the mandatories were an art form. The transitions as he moved from post to post, it was like ballet. You know, mm-hmm. you never see that now. It's all breathing and spitting. And you know, I always say to guys, look as if you're enjoying it, even if you think it's tough. Smile. The audience wants to see a reaction. Don't make it look hard. I think sometimes some good guys go on there saying, if I make it look hard, they think, oh, he must be in shape because he's worked his ass off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But you're there to entertain and to get into the audience.
All right. Thank you for that interview with Lonnie Teeper and Peter McGuff. I want to thank both of those guys for taking the time to come on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And as I mentioned, we will have part two of that interview with Lonnie and Peter next week on the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. I want to thank our sponsors, Old School Labs and Florida Alternative Medicine, for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. And before we go, I'm going to read this article that was sent to us by my friend Pat Comer. And this is an interview that Studs Terkel, who was a very famous author, and I remember Studs because he was back in the Chicago area for many, many years. So Studs did an interview with Arnold, and this had to be, as I said, probably in the late 70s, early 80s, when Arnold just got out of bodybuilding and he was going into the movies. So it gives insight into a young Arnold Schwarzenegger. So here it is. It's called Arnold Schwarzenegger's Dream. It says, call me Arnold. I was born in a little Austrian town outside Graz. It was a 300-year-old house. When I was 10 years old, I had a dream of being the best in the world in something. When I was 15, I had a dream that I wanted to be the best bodybuilder in the world and the most muscular man. It was not only a dream I dreamed at night, it was also a daydream. It took me 5 years of hard work. 5 years later, I turned this dream into reality, and I became Mr. Universe, the best built man in the world. Winning is a very important word. There is one that achieves what he wanted to achieve, and there are hundreds of thousands that failed. It singles you out, the winner, a second three times. But that is not what I call losing. The bottom line for me was Arnold has to be the winner. I have to win more often the Mr. Universe title than anybody else. I won it 5 times consecutively. I hold the record as Mr. Olympia, the top professional bodybuilding championship. I won it 6 times. That's why I retired. There was nobody even close to me. Everybody gave up competing against me. That's what I call a winner. My dream was not to be big physically, but big in a way that everybody listens to me when I talk, that I'm a very important person, that people recognize me and see me as something special. I had a big need for being singled out. Also, my dream was to end up in America. When I was 10 years old, I dreamed of being an American. At the time, I didn't know much about America, just that it was a wonderful country. I felt it was where I belonged. I didn't like being in a little country like Austria. I did everything possible to get out. I did so in 1968 when I was 21 years old. If I would believe in life after death, I would say my before life, I was living in America. That's why I feel so good here, where you can turn your dream into reality. Other countries don't have those things. When I came over here to America, I felt I was in heaven. In America, we don't have an obstacle. Nobody's holding you back. Number one in America pretty much takes care of the rest of the world. You kind of run through the rest of the world like nothing. I'm trying to make people in America aware that they should appreciate what they have here. We have the best tax advantages here and the best prices here and the best products here. One of the things I always had was a business mind. When I was in high school, a majority of my classes were business classes, economics and accounting and mathematics. When I came over here to this country, I really didn't speak English almost at all. I learned English and then I started taking business courses because that's what America is best known for, business. Turning $1 into $1 million in a short period of time. Also, when you make money, how do you keep it? That's one of the most important things when you have money in your hand. How can you keep it or make more of it? Real estate is one of the best ways of doing that. I own apartment buildings, office buildings, and raw land. That's my love, real estate. I have emotions, but when you do, you keep them cold or you store them away for a time. You must control your emotions. You must have command over yourself. 3-4 months before a competition, I could not be interfered by other people's problems. This is sometimes called selfish. It's the only way you can be if you want to achieve something. Any emotional things inside me, I try to keep cold so it doesn't interfere with my training. Many times things really touch me. I felt them and I felt sensitive about them, but I had to talk myself out of it. I had to suppress those feelings in order to go on. Sport is one of those activities where you really have to concentrate. You must pay attention 100% to the particular thing you're doing. There must be nothing else on your mind. Emotions must not interfere. Otherwise, you're thinking about your girlfriend. You're in love. Your positive energies get channeled into another direction rather than going into the weight room or making money. You have to choose at a very early date what you want, a normal life or to achieve things you want to achieve. I never wanted to win a popularity contest and doing things the way people want me to do it. I went the road I thought for me. A few people thought I was cold, selfish. Later, they found out that's not the case. After I achieve my goal, I can be Mr. Nice Guy. You know what I mean? California is, to me, a dreamland. It's the absolute combination of everything I was always looking for. It has all the money in the world there, show business there, wonderful weather there, beautiful country, ocean is there, snow skiing in the winter. You can go in the desert the same day. You have beautiful looking people there. They all have a tan. I believe very strongly in the philosophy of staying hungry. If you have a dream and it becomes a reality, don't stay satisfied with it too long. Make up a new dream and hunt after that one and turn it into reality. When you have that dream achieved, make up a new dream. I am a strong believer in Western philosophy, the philosophy of success, of progress, of getting rich. The Eastern philosophy is, which I believe in maybe 3% of the time, and the 97% is Western, conquering and going on. It's a beautiful philosophy, and America should keep it up. 1980. This was. All right. Thank you, Pat Comer, for sending me that. I really liked it. All right. Thanks, guys, for listening to another episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast. We will be back next week with part two of our interview with Lonnie Tieper and Peter McGuff. Thank you to Florida Alternative Medicine and Old School Labs for sponsoring this episode of the Bodybuilding Legends podcast, and we'll see you next week. Take care.